Well, good evening. I think we're almost ready to start. If you could take your seats. If you're still standing, you might like to sit down now.
Good evening. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here this evening for a discussion of the War on Terror, learning the lessons, right and wrong, from the Cold War. It's a particular pleasure to be here this evening because we have two of our very own LSE profs here, both co-directors of the LSE Cold War Studies Center. Mick Cox, known to no doubt all of you here, is a professor in the International Relations Department, and I did a little bit of searching around for his areas of interest today as he self-describes them, and to the LSE experts it says, keywords, USA, 11th September, international terrorism, transatlantic relations, Cold War, American power, and special relationship. So I thought, well, that's an odd thing to add at the end of it. But since I know this special relationship is in the audience, we needn't say more. He's the author of many works, including E.H. Carr, A Critical Appraisal, Empires, Systems, and States, and has a new book coming out soon, America at War. Professor Arnie Westad is in the International History Department, and his keywords are Chinese Communist Party, Chinese Foreign Policy, Cold War, East Asian International History, Soviet Foreign Policy, Third World Relations. So together they cover all bases, it seems to me, for tonight's topic. He has a very distinguished publication, History, but I mentioned two forthcoming texts this evening, The Global Cold War, Third World Interventions and the Making of Our Times, and a three-volume edited collection for the Cambridge History of the Cold War, which is, if it's the Cambridge History, a very authoritative collection indeed. Both our speakers will speak for 20 minutes or so. Then I thought if you wouldn't mind, you might take a minute to comment on each other's contributions. And then, we'll have questions. I hope this evening will be relatively informal and relaxed, and there'll be time to pursue some issues in some depth. So, Mick, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much, David.
Thanks for that introduction, David. I'm sorry about all those keywords. President Bush, as I'm sure many in this audience would agree, has many fine qualities. Pause. David did say I've got to be informal this evening. But a deep love of learning for its own sake, it is agreed, is not one of them. Like that other famous neoconservative American president, I mean Ronald Reagan, Bush obviously prefers his ranch to his study. Working out on his body, not on his mind. Yet if recent well-founded rumors, and The Economist has said they're true, so it must be so, if recent well-founded rumors are to be believed, the president has become much enamored of late of one very particular book. This has been written by Natan Sharansky, originally Anatoly Sharansky. The book is called The Case for Democracy, The Power of Freedom to Overcome Tyranny and Terror. President Bush has clearly been very, very impressed by this book, which he has read. He has made it clear, and I quote from the president, "If you want a glimpse of how I think about foreign policy, read this book. I would put it on the recommended list." David, maybe for the globalization course that you're involved in. And then he continued, "It's short." "And it's good." I assume it's good because it's short. The president continued in the same intellectual mode, "This guy is a heroic figure. This book is great." Now, it's an interesting phenomenon, not just that the president has finally decided to read a book, but the particular book that he's decided to read and one which, if you read, and I have glimpsed at it, and then compare it to some of the statements made recently by the President, both in his State of Union speech to the Congress and indeed in his inaugural speech, you would say that Mr. Sharansky must have written both of those speeches. Hearing Bush, you hear Sharansky. And the central theme of Sharansky, which I'll talk about, and I'll come back to the theme then of the Cold War and the War on Terror, the central theme of the book is linking the spread of democracy, the promotion of democracy by the United States, to security. And linking the broader spread of freedom in Iraq, firstly, the Middle East more generally, to the fight against terror. Hence the title of the book, The Case for Democracy, The Power of Freedom to Overcome Tyranny and Terror. In other words, this may not be a very brilliant book. It may not get on the RAE four-star list. It may not have many footnotes, but it is a very, very influential book. Indeed, I've often found that some of the worst books in history are some of the most influential. And this may be a good example of this, to which one can reasonably ask the question, well, so what? What's the connection with tonight's roundtable on the Cold War, historical lessons and legacies on the one hand, and what we've now been called the War on Terror? Well, there's a very, very clear connection. I'm simply using the Sharansky volume and the connection to Bush to make the connection between the past, something which some regard as being dead, which I don't think it is, and the present. And recall who Sharansky is and who Sharansky was. Sharansky is an Israeli citizen, indeed a very active citizen who champions the rights of the settlers in Israel, very forcefully, it has to be said. Sharansky is also a very important citizen in Israel. In March 2001, he was appointed Minister of Housing and Construction, which I think in Israel is a very important position, and also Deputy Prime Minister. He's now Minister without portfolio in the government of Ariel Sharon. That's who Sharansky is. But who was Sharansky? Indeed, when he was Anatoly, rather than as he is now, Natan. Well, Sharansky was a very interesting figure in the Cold War. He was one of the very several thousand people who left the USSR, the Soviet Union as it then was, some years before it collapsed, because of his dissident activity. Sharansky, just to give you a little background, applied for a visa, a difficult thing to do in the Soviet Union, in the early 1970s, in 1973 to be exact, to go to Israel. Not surprisingly, he was at that point at least refused. 4 years later, Anatoly Sharansky then, as he was called, was arrested. And he was sentenced in 1978 in the old Soviet Union to 13 years in prison, quote unquote, for spying on behalf of the United States. 8 years later, in 1986, only 3 years before the end of the Cold War, he was set free as part of a prisoner exchange. I actually remember that very well because it's just like something out of a Le Carré novel. Sharansky actually was exchanged on that famous bridge on the German border with a number of people from the other side and finally arrived in Israel the same year. Now, by any measure, Anatoly Sharansky was a victim of the Cold War and, it has to be said, to a player in it as well, very much so. Indeed, if you follow the trajectory of Sharansky from dissident to Israeli citizen, there was interesting mediating moments along the way. He certainly admired one of the Cold War's toughest warriors, namely Ronald Reagan. In fact, if you read Sharansky's memoirs and what he has said subsequently in speeches, he believes that Ronald Reagan's tough line in the period of the 1980s, between 1980 and 1988, in that two-term presidency, believes that tough line and what he calls the moral clarity of Ronald Reagan, his refusal to compromise and appease with what he called then the evil empire, remember that phrase, an interesting one in terms of the terms today used about the axis of evil, he believes that it was Reagan, Reagan's military build-up, but also his moral clarity, his ability to distinguish between right and wrong, between good and bad, that there could be no neutrals in the Cold War, that was Reagan's central line, that this helped bring about, if it didn't, in fact, contribute fundamentally to the end of the Cold War in 1989. Not surprisingly, Ronald Reagan, like President Bush today, rather liked Anatoly Sharansky. Indeed, he admired him so much that he awarded him a medal in 1989. They met. Sharansky then recalled a story about the evil empire. When Ronnie made the speech in 83, 82, he made this, used this phraseology to describe the USSR as an evil empire. And then he met Ronald Reagan in the White House once he had been freed in, after 86, told the story to President Reagan, to Ronald. Ronald was completely taken aback. He thought, what a wonderful story. And Sharansky recalls this. He brought everybody into the White House to say, hey, listen to this guy. Somebody listened to my speech. At least somebody did. Anatoly Sharansky clearly did. And for this, he was awarded the Medal of Freedom in 1989. Nobody's ever done that some of my speeches. However, perhaps after tonight, there may be somebody out there awarding some Medals of Freedom, and I can perhaps pick one up on the way out. Now, but this is the important connection we're trying to make in this roundtable this evening. Sharansky, I think, like many, both in Israel, but certainly in the United States, and certainly on the Republican right, many of those in and around this administration, even in the second term, which is now putting talcum powder all over it to show that it loves Europeans and foreigners, Sharansky drew one very important lesson from how the Cold War was fought and how the Cold War ended and why it ended. He believed it ended, as does George Bush today, by the way, because liberty and freedom were put central to American foreign policy in the fight against communism and the fight against the Soviet Union. There wouldn't be kind of realist compromises with the superpowers, with the other superpower. There wouldn't be a balance of power. There was a struggle going on, a moral struggle against this evil empire, and it was Ronald Reagan's great contribution, again, a very intellectually under-equipped president, it has to be said, but that doesn't matter, who put the fight for freedom and liberty as an essential element in the fight against the USSR and communism. And draws the obvious comparison, and this is a very direct one, that the way Ronald Reagan fought and won the Cold War is precisely the same way in which President Bush has formulated the struggle against terrorism today, as a moral struggle, one without compromise, and one in which the promotion and spread of freedom led by the United States is absolutely critical. The two fights, both intellectually, conceptually, and historically, simply cannot be separated. Moreover, if we're to come out of the present crisis, the war on terror period, victorious, in much the same way that the United States was victorious against communism, then we have to wage the war against communism, now the war against terror, in the same uncompromising way. We cannot take half measures. There cannot be neutrals in the fight against the axis of evil, no more than there could ever be compromise or neutrals in the fight against communism. That, in essence, is the message in the book so admired by George W. Bush today. Now, I simply use this example to illustrate what I think is a rather obvious but actually very important point. And certainly it's informed a large part of this lecture series and what we're trying to do with the Cold War Studies Center. It's one of the things we're trying to do with the Cold War Studies Center. That is to argue that lessons drawn from the Cold War, ideas about how the Cold War came to an end, continue to shape U.S. foreign policy in very many ways. Indeed, the more we look at the present, it seems to me that it is impossible not to be struck by how much the Cold War and its legacy lives on. The fingerprints of the Cold War, to use a phrase, the past, supposedly dead, can be found all over the present and all over this particular administration. I want to suggest at least five obvious ways in which the Cold War lives on, in which that so-called dead period continues to inhabit the present. Firstly, and not specifically only about the war on communism, of course, there are still some fundamental unresolved problems from the Cold War. If we were to argue, what are some of the key foreign policy problems confronting the United States today, whoever was in office, whether it was Bush or Kerry or the Democrats or the Republicans, if you were to say a list of what are the key fundamental foreign policy problems facing any American administration today, indeed the West more generally, if there is such a term as the West, I'm told there's not, then you'd have to say, what's the ranking order? Well, frankly, if you weren't on an illegal substance, you'd have to start with North Korea. There is a very clear illustration of a Cold War problem which lives on in a very remarkable way. You'd also have to add China to that. Still today, the American administration, while viewing the development of capitalism in China in a most positive way, seeing the development of China as an essential element in the stability of modern capitalism, and certainly paying up the U.S. debt, and thank God that they continue to do so, nonetheless, they still see China through the Cold War prism that it is run by a one-party state, run by those who still view the world increasingly through capitalist eyes, but with very powerful views of the past and a communist ideology influencing the way they both run China and the way they view the world. Indeed, it's interesting that when the Bush administration came into office in early 2001, those first interesting National Security Council meetings, long before Al-Qaeda delivered its coup against New York and Washington in September, if you look through those first National Security Council meetings, what is really very top of the list for many of the administration is China. What to do about China? Is China something to be worked with, engaged with, or is it something to be contained? China as enemy was still very fundamental to the way the administration viewed the world then, and I think still in many respects still views China today. And finally, of course, Russia. Still the deep suspicions of Russia, and particularly about Mr. Putin, in spite of this quasi-alliance which both Russia and China have with the United States today, still is influenced by the fact that Putin came out of the KGB stable, the fact that Russia is re-centralizing, and that Russia is returning, in a sense, to a kind of quasi-Russian-stroke-communist past. So even at the most simple empirical level of looking at states, forget about the generalized war on terror, the kind of non-governmental actors such as Al-Qaeda and the globalized forms that takes, still some of their fundamental unresolved problems are derived from the Cold War. And when I hear people say, well, the Cold War is over, it ended in 1989, not only is that a fantastically Eurocentric view of the Cold War, it simply is empirically untrue, because many of the fundamental policy problems facing the United States today, whoever is in the office of president, are problems derived from the long-term struggle between capitalism and communism, of which North Korea, China, and Russia are pretty obvious examples. Let us also add another factor here. Nuclear weapons were a central problem in the Cold War. They weren't produced by the Cold War, of course. Historically, they came up through the Second World War and the period then. But nevertheless, nuclear weapons were fundamental to that Cold War. And the fear of the proliferation of nuclear weapons was a fundamental Cold War concern. And what's top of many agendas today, particularly in Washington, is this issue of nuclear weapons and their proliferation. This, again, shows us very clearly, in a very direct way, the ways in which the past inhabits the present, in which the past, in a sense, is the present, and the present cannot be understood without a clear reference to that past which so-called died in 1989. It is purely ahistorical to suggest otherwise. Secondly, the origins of this present crisis are rooted in, to put bluntly, radical Islam. Where did that come from? The enemy which struck the United States so dramatically and graphically on 9/11. The day that changed the world forever, or whatever. Where did that radical Islamism come? Well, it came from many sources, of course. But it also came from a Cold War struggle. If you go back to the late 1970s, where was the crisis in the Cold War? Where was the point of real crisis in the Cold War? It wasn't actually in Central Europe. It was partly in Africa. It was certainly in Central America. And it persisted to some degree in Southeast Asia. But the heart of that, as Fred Halliday has pointed out in many of his wonderful writings on this, the arc of crisis was the Middle East. The fear of spreading radical nationalism and, of course, then the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. To whom did the United States turn in the struggle against the Soviet Union? To whom did the United States and indeed the British turn to defeat the Russians and to kill as many Russians as possible in Afghanistan? They turned to exactly the same kinds of people who then launched the attack on the United States on 9/11, to radical Islam. Ronald Reagan has a number of wonderful quotes. Not just Ronald Reagan, by the way. Go to Brzinoy Brzezinski. Go back to the Jimmy Carter period of the late 1970s. Again, they plumped for Islam, of radicalized Sunni Islam, as a major means both of military struggle and ideological struggle against radical nationalism, against perceived threats of communism, and, of course, against the Russians and the Soviet Union within Afghanistan today. Bin Laden was the friend who got away. He is the blowback from the Cold War who came back as Frankenstein-like to attack the United States on 9/11. Moreover, critical to the fight against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and critical also to the broader fight against radical nationalism and secularism, actually, too, in the Middle East, were states such as Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. And they have also come back to haunt the United States since 9/11 as well. And they played a vital role, both in terms of intelligence, in terms of support, in terms of money, in the larger struggle against the bigger enemy called communism or the Soviet Union in the 1980s. That continues, that persists. There's another historical legacy. We can see the legacy of the Cold War too, frankly, in terms of the people who are in the current administration. I mean, does everybody think that in 1989, everybody who had been involved with the Cold War suddenly had a brain bypass? Suddenly they had new personalities injected with the word globalization, democracy promotion, human rights? Of course they didn't. Of course they didn't. They were bypassed, of course, by the Clinton administration. One of the reasons, it's an interesting phenomenon, the extent to which they came to hate a fairly centrist administration such as the Clinton people. But that's an interesting question in its own right. But if one looks again at the kinds of people at the heart of this administration today, almost to a person, and I nearly said to a man, but one of them isn't, obviously. She was in Europe last week, were formed and structured within a Cold War framework. Condoleezza Rice, who was never called a neoconservative, who was a wonderful pianist and who can skate, you know, do all the things that George can't, I'm told. If one goes back into her bibliography, into her own writings, it's very much on the Soviet Union. But don't just take Condoleezza Rice as a kind of exemplar of this continuity. Look at Donald Rumsfeld. Grew up politically in the Nixon years. Donald Rumsfeld brought on the young Cheney. They, in turn, patronized the young Mr. Paul Wolfowitz at the time. And they were all shaped by the great battles of the 1970s in the American foreign policy establishment. And what were those battles about in the 1970s in the American foreign policy establishment? Don't appease the Soviet Union. Don't get engaged in arms control with the USSR. There is a Soviet threat. There was a huge struggle for the soul of American foreign policy in the 1970s, and it was finally won by the right. It was finally won by the right. And indeed brought Reagan to power, of course, and two-term presidency of the first American neoconservatives. It's interesting, too, looking at some of the appointments down the list. And there's always one interesting one I always love using. Fred used it here in a lecture. John Negroponte, current U.S. ambassador to Iraq. And he's an interesting man, Mr. Negroponte. I've looked at his biography. It's a very interesting. He was one-time U.S. ambassador to that very nice little place called Honduras in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was then backing the Contras, the freedom fighters of their time, against indigenous communists and nationalists and peasant organizers, human rights organizers, and the rest. And of course, in good Reaganite style, didn't bother too much with the details. You just piled bodies up. You just piled bodies up. And they were piled up very high in Nicaragua. They were piled up extraordinarily high in Guatemala, and they were also piled up very high in Honduras. If you read through the reports given by Mr. Negroponte when he was then ambassador to Honduras, as somebody put it very nicely, if you read through Negroponte's reports on Honduras, you would think that Honduras was Norway. Interestingly, Condoleezza Rice coined a term to describe this continuity of personnel from those great Cold War struggles and the lessons that they learned and continue to apply to the current period. She called them the Vulcans. This wonderful phrase, the Vulcans, this wonderful book, by the way, by the American author James Mann, which shows these huge personnel continuities. I think that then brings us to the question of the larger outlook. How does this administration see the world more generally? How does it look at the world more generally? I think it views the world conditioned by a view of the Cold War and how America won the Cold War. Here comes the story, and Arnie will no doubt elaborate on this in a bit more detail in his own presentation. The Cold War, as Sharansky believes, and as George Bush believes, as indeed many of the current administration believe, the Cold War was won for a variety of complicated reasons, but at the heart of victory was Ronald Reagan, with a particular strategy, with a particular morality, with a particular attempt to revitalize American power and revitalize American containment. The problem was, and this is part of their general argument, and it's been repeated time and again, that victory in the Cold War in 1989 over communism in Europe and then finally over the USSR in 1991 was not translated into realities on the ground under Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton dropped the ball. Bill Clinton lost the plot. Bill Clinton didn't seize the time and extend the possibilities of the post-Cold War, post-Soviet period into a new form of American hegemony. And there's some wonderful phrases which have come partly out of the neoconservatives, but out of others. There's a wonderful one I love from Charles Krauthammer, who's written very much and influenced part of this current debate about American grand strategy in the current period. History went on holiday in the years of Clinton. Clinton's own CIA officer, a CIA director, whom of course hated each other enormously, said, Clinton thought we were on an extended beach party. That's what he saw the world as being. Globalization would resolve things, democracy would solve things, Bill would solve things, multilateral institutions would solve things. We all took an extended beach party. In this sense, therefore, what happened on 9/11 has to be seen both as crisis and as a return to real world politics for many within this administration. In some senses, the 1990s, which, by the way, saw living standards in America rising, saw fewer people on unemployment benefit, which actually saw some very good things, I think, happening in the world because of Clinton. I will say that very openly. It's not a very popular thing to say these days. It doesn't get me too many invitations to the American embassy, I know. Nonetheless, they view the Clinton years, this period of peace and stability, which American people voted for, by the way, in huge numbers on two occasions, and he would have voted for a third time if Bill could have only, you know, if only could have taken the third term, they view this now as a kind of period of neglect, a decade in which history went on holiday, we took an extended beach party, the opportunities presented by Reagan's great victory of 89 and 91 were not fully seized. In that respect, therefore, 9/11 becomes a wake-up call. It's a reminder about how the world really is. It's about the way the world not ought to be, but that's just simply the way the world happens to be, and Clinton didn't understand that. Indeed, one would like to ask whether George Bush's father fully understood it either. So it's a reminder of the real world, and it has to be said too, and I think people like Condoleezza Rice have come pretty close to saying this without saying it quite openly, it presented a form of opportunity as well, of a kind of mobilization. A mobilization in the same way that the Cold War presented a possibilities of mobilization of American power. And of course, you may raise the larger question as to whether a great power like the United States, and one doesn't have to get into kind of territory occupied by Noam Chomsky and others, but whether or not a great power, in order to mobilize its own citizens, in order to mobilize its own great power, needs a threat, requires one. Certainly, this administration feels, I think, in some sense, philosophically, much happier with a threat, with a perceived notion there's a clear enemy there. Because, in a sense, that's the way a superpower operates, with the other, with the conditioning of another, to provide it with that point, that loaded North Star, that point of reference around which you can organize your foreign policy, mobilize support, and hopefully, although it didn't work this time around, mobilize your allies as well. Finally, I think the link is there in terms of conditions of international order. And I think, again, here, very important lessons were drawn from the Cold War. Several, by the way, but I'll only mention two because I want to now pass on to Arnie very quickly. One, the condition of victory in the Cold War, the condition of order in the Cold War, I think was very much conditioned by a view that America had to remain prime. Primacy was essential. And central to primacy was military superiority, what is now called, I think, full-spectrum dominance, as it is now referred to. Military superiority gives you the confidence to do certain things. Military superiority deters enemies. Military superiority also sends a message to your friends. It also sends messages to others. If America is so superior, then nobody's going to try and challenge it. Indeed, very interestingly, in one of the very interesting reports in 1992, which was actually in which Cheney was involved and Wolfowitz were involved, which never was fully published, although there are versions of it around, they made the point very clearly, and I thought it was a very cold, interesting argument, very much one derived from the Cold War. If we are so far ahead militarily, not only are we going to deter enemies, usually states, of course, that was this kind of statist way of thinking about it, anybody who simply wants to try and catch up with us won't bother. Simply won't bother. And I think here, by the way, they were thinking not only of China, but I think they were also thinking of the Europeans. I think the second point, and I've also alluded to it, of course, is the question of threat. I am not for one moment saying the threat is a pure device. I mean, the kind of Chomsky argument that says, oh, the Soviet threat was simply invented. How useful the Soviet Union was. Well, fine. Of course there was a Soviet threat in some sense. Clearly, communism constituted a fundamental problem of world order from the point of view of the United States and the economic and political order it sought to defend, obviously. In the same way, although different ideological kind of argument, it can be said about global terrorism as well. There is a threat. Nobody's denying that. But the question becomes one of how useful that threat becomes, how important that threat becomes. And I think if one looks at the 1990s, there's a kind of sense which the 1990s was a very difficult period, precisely because Clinton did not think in those kinds of terms. He saw a series of hierarchical problems, difficulties, nuclear proliferation, the problems of China, a whole series of things, but no single defining threat. We are now in a period where there is one, where there is one. So my thesis really is a very simple one, derived from the original statement about the Sharansky book, that the Cold War lives. We can find the connections. History has not died. When we, Arnie and I, decided a couple of years ago to put together the Cold War Studies Center, one of the questions which was often put back to us, or by way of critique, I think, more than anything else, was, well, isn't the Cold War over? Isn't it finished? You know, can't we leave the Cold War to people like, well, Arnie? You know, he can go off into the archives, get dust all over him. Arnie reads about 17 different languages, including Norwegian. Not surprising, he's from Norway. So can't we just leave history to the historians? What's it got to do with us today? My point here this evening, and of course part of what we've been trying to do in this lecture series, is to try and show those very real connections, Which brings me to the very final point. Has this administration drawn the right lessons? Well, this is a difficult one. After all, America won the Cold War. I mean, that's pretty good. That's pretty good, because nobody thought they were going to win it. Capitalism triumphed over communism. You know, there's reasons for hubris sometimes. However, I think there are certain lessons which have not been drawn and certain wrong lessons which have been drawn. And I'll just mention two. Firstly, I don't think the Cold War was won simply and merely by relying on military instruments or by being tough or by sending in the troops or anything like that. It was by being more productive economically, more attractive politically. Indeed, the more tough you try to be, the less influential you might end up being, which of course I think is a fundamental dilemma of this particular administration. It has masses of raw power, masses of hard power, but its attractive influence globally has declined. And of course what we're now seeing in this second administration is a desperate effort to recapture the kind of moral and political high ground they thought they occupied, and indeed did occupy, in the weeks and months immediately following 9/11. They know they made huge diplomatic errors, and they're trying to catch up. Also, and this is another important point to remember, the war against the Soviet Union, against communism, like the war on terror, that old war and this current war led to huge abuses of human rights. It's all very well saying that democracy won the Cold War for the United States, as Sharansky does. It is an extraordinarily one-dimensional view of world politics generally, and indeed how the Cold War came to an end. But he never looks at the cost of the Cold War. The Cold War involved torture. The Cold War involved alliances with fascism, with dictators, with death squads. That's what it involved. It involved killing thousands, possibly millions of innocent people, and maybe not so innocent people, but that's what it involved.
It had huge consequences for human rights. You did deals with the devil. And I think, again, one of the problems that the United States is confronting now is that the very means they are using or employing to fight the war on terror, we don't need to go into all the details of Abu Ghraib, the whole question of treatments of prisoners around the world, the alliances with Uzbekistan, with China, with Russia, and all these other things, involve the same types of deals with the devil to fight the larger enemy. So as somebody who's actually a friend of the United States in the last analysis, although some of you may not believe it after what I've said this evening, but I am, nonetheless, I think that some of the things the United States needs to do as well is draw some of the right lessons from the way the Cold War was fought and won, and not always the wrong ones. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Well, shaking off the dust of the archives,
you historian,
and trying to address issues that social scientists and historians, at least for tonight, would have in common, I must say that I think we've given ourselves a rather difficult brief, Mekinoi, for this particular roundtable. Lessons from the Cold War for the War on Terror. And for someone who is rather skeptical of the existence of historical lessons, at least lessons that can be implemented by policymakers, because every one of us tend to read history very differently, I want to start with one of my favorite Soviet-era jokes, one that was told thousands of times around dinner tables in Moscow during the Brezhnev era, and I laughed as well every time when it was presented with the necessary accompaniments of nibbles and lots of vodka. It's about Alexander, Hannibal, and Napoleon, who are reborn and who are brought to the Kremlin to watch the annual Revolution Day parade with all the military hardware paraded in front of them. And Alexander looks at all of this and he says, if I had artillery like this, I would have conquered the world. Hannibal looks at the Soviet tanks, the T-72s and others, and he says, you know, if I had tanks like these, crossing the Alps would not have been a problem at all. Then Napoleon looks up from his copy of Pravda and he says, if I'd had a newspaper like this, no one would ever have known that I lost the Battle of Waterloo. It is still one of my favorite Soviet jokes.
That's the way he tells it.
Propaganda is an essential element of all kinds of warfare. And this goes for the Cold War, as in the example of Pravda, but also writings on the Western side, and it goes for the so-called War on Terror. It's as true during the Cold War as it is today. And what I enjoy most about being an historian of these matters is getting behind the propaganda through access to documents in dusty archives and elsewhere, and to sources that those in power did not intend outsiders to see. That's a fun part of being an historian. That's what I like. The slightly subversive side of all of it. The problem, of course, here is that many of these documents, many of these materials were kept secret for a very good reason. If they had not been kept secret, then others, people outside the field of high politics, could construct a narrative of events quite different from the one implicit in official propaganda. So being an historian in this sense, an historian of the Cold War, and trying to link the past to the present, as we do through the Cold War Center here at LSE, certainly, as Mick made abundantly clear in his remarks, includes what I'd call a healthy disrespect for power, for all kinds of power and whatever way it is being presented. It also means, I think, that one has to be very critical of definitions. The Cold War was much of what happened in the later part of the 20th century, but it was in no way everything. Lots of things were going on, and I hope we'll have some time to discuss this later on, that pointed to the situation today that were not really created by the Cold War in any meaningful sense. I mean, international society in the late 20th century is much more diverse than the Cold War, and we're seeing some of the effects of that today. Now, to a much higher extent, the so-called War on Terror is one of many directions in present-day international affairs. I mean, the attempt by the present Bush administration, and I must say the government of this country, to subsume everything that is happening in the world under the headline, the War on Terror, in terms of your alliance patterns, in terms of your technological development and so on, is not just misleading, it's straightforwardly false. The war on terror itself, at least in my book, is a meaningless concept. You could as well launch a war on heavy artillery, or a war on slingshots, for that matter. It is a matter of confronting the methods that your enemy use rather than the political context and the political content that they represent. So to me, what the war on terror really means is the reformulation of US foreign policy after September 11th to stress preemption, military intervention, unilateral decision making. Now, none of these tendencies are new in American policymaking, and I'll go back to that a little bit later on. But the present administration are taking them to extremes. And it's also very important here that this extremist American globalist agenda comes after a period of almost unique multilateralism in American history from the mid-1980s and up to 2001, up to September 11th. And the main topic of my comments tonight will really be on the dramatic changes that took place from the last phase of the Cold War up to our own time. What is it that has engineered these changes? But I also want to show how some of these key ideological elements of US foreign policy go back to well before the Cold War even started, a part of the global agenda that was formed in a much earlier time and age among American elites. And lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the revolutionary challenges, particularly in the Third World, that the United States and its allies are responding to, in my view, more or less unsuccessfully at present, and how much of this also comes out of the Cold War agenda, or what you could term an American hegemonical agenda that goes much further back than the Cold War itself. Now, I want to work a little bit on rehabilitating Ronald Reagan. I was rather shocked when I saw the prominent neoconservative, Norman Podhoretz, defining the present President Bush as, and I quote him, a passionate democratic idealist of the Reaganite stamp, unquote. Which, of course, reminds everyone who studied the Soviet Union of the wonderful phrase from some years back, a passionate communist in the Stalin mold. Now, it's true, as Mick pointed out, that the Reagan administration most certainly was the most ideological U.S. administration probably since John Kennedy's. It emphasized freedom, concepts of freedom, not just in the United States itself, but globally, that this was the key to understanding America's mission in the world. It underlined very strongly from the very beginning the confrontation with evil, and the need to strike down on whatever will seem to be threatening not just freedom, but everything that is good and just among us, as Reagan liked to put it himself. It also, and I'll probably put more emphasis on this than Mick did, it also emphasized that this was a cultural war that encompassed the United States itself. Reagan wanted to battle the enemy within as much as the enemy without. And much of what was being said about the Soviet Union and much that was being said about the Cold War, especially in Europe, was really directed towards what the Reaganites saw as their domestic enemies. American liberals, and especially, of course, the rather minuscule American left at university campuses mostly, that were the Reagan administration's pet objects of hatred. There were some rather extreme figures in the first Reagan administration. My favorite example is Richard Pipes, a great historian of Russia. You should really read his work. I think you'd benefit a lot from it. But in political context of the 1980s, really on the extreme libertarian wing. He was someone who'd spent most of his time in a political context before he joined the Reagan administration as the NSC expert on Russia, being involved in a lawsuit against the against Massachusetts, the state of Massachusetts, on the issue of the unconstitutionality of license plates for cars. And he's, of course, someone who were able to set the agenda at the very beginning of the first Reagan administration. We also heard about some of the others, but Paul Wolfowitz is a brilliant example coming from the same camp, although he had a slightly different trajectory. Now, what I find interesting, though, when you think about Podoretz and others' characterization of George W. Bush, is that what happened in the Reagan administration seems to be very different from what is happening within the Bush administration today. While many of his chief aides stayed on the right fringe, dealing with their other, their partial agendas, their different aspects of policymaking in a little way, they could conduct their own crusades, which is actually a quote from the president himself, Reagan moved towards the center as his re-election campaign approached in 1984. From 1984 on, and to me this is a crucial element in how the Cold War ended, there was much more multilateralism, much more negotiations, much less rhetoric within the Reagan administration, both with regard to the Soviet Union, but especially with regard to the European allies of the United States and allies elsewhere in the world, for that matter. Japan is a wonderful example in point. The point was, for Reagan, that he knew that he needed to deliver. He needed to deliver on the matters that really were important to him, the reasons why he felt that he had been elected and on which he was seeking re-election. There's also this sense with Reagan to complete the rehabilitation job. And I think much of what we find in the, maybe not so dusty yet, but collecting dust sort of archives, is that he knew what he was after. He was a simple man, but he knew what he was after on the big issues, on issues such as arms control, the relationship with the Soviet Union, with China, and not least with American allies in Europe. It didn't create a wonderful and intellectually challenging foreign policy agenda, but it was a definition of what the Reagan administration, or at least the president himself, wanted to achieve in the second term. I would argue that much of that was in place well before the changes started to happen in the Soviet Union. Indeed, much of what happened later in the 1980s would have been impossible to explain without these changes taking place in the conservative wing of American politics in the late 1980s. And this is where the comparison with the current Bush administration that is set on confrontation to us in as much of an extent in its second period as in its first period. In spite of what Condi Rice now is saying, the basic parameters are still in place. If you listen to what she said in Paris, is, you know, by all means let us be friends, but we will not move one iota from the agenda that was drawn up during the first Bush administration. I also tend to think, this is one of the other fields where it's wonderful to be an historian and not have to make up great and fancy theories about all the explanations that you come up with, that personality matters in these kinds of cases. Reagan was as unafraid, sonnily optimistic, secure in making decisions, even when he made the wrong decisions, as the current president is nail-bitingly and almost tediously insecure. Someone who knows, or he believes he knows, who he is representing in terms of American politics, but cannot really put this together as a domestic agenda, as we're seeing at the moment, or as a foreign policy agenda, and seems to be nervously aware of that, increasingly so after having been reelected, which is rather striking when you think about earlier presidents who've been reelected for a second term. Now, it could also be said, of course, and I'm sure some of you will say this after my attempts at rehabilitating Ronald Reagan, that Reagan got lucky. Osama bin Laden is no Mikhail Gorbachev.
Can I quote on that?
Certainly to Gorbachev. If you've contacted that other direction, I would be more fearful. Negotiations mattered to Gorbachev as much as they mattered to Ronald Reagan. And certainly it was the agenda set on the Soviet side that created many of the concrete initiatives that came out of the late 1980s. But what that argument is missing is that Islamism as a global movement, diverse as it is, and I'll return to this towards the end of my remarks today, is not Osama bin Laden. It's not what we generally tend to think of as al-Qaeda. It is an important direction in the development of third world politics, in some countries increasingly important. What the present administration is doing is closing all chances of any form of peace with Islamist movements, defined, at least for now, as the main enemy of the United States on a global scale. Iran, I won't go into that now, but you see what is happening in terms of the saber-rattling with regard to the current regime in Tehran. Iraq, of course, where the United States is bogged down in a meaningless war that is going nowhere. Possibly tomorrow, or next week, or next year, Saudi Arabia, after it meets a challenge from below, which I think will both be religious and social in character. There is no mechanism in place, ideologically or politically, for the United States to take these kinds of movements seriously, to set up an agenda for negotiation, an agenda for interaction. And this brings us to the links between the Bush administration, the current Bush administration, and US foreign policy ideology over the longer continuum. I said earlier on that intervention, preemption, unilateralism, the defining elements of Bush's policy today, that these are not new inventions in US foreign policy. Of course, the Cold War shows that better than anything. I mean, how these different forms of ideological cause were created and recreated in American foreign policy. They even go much further back than that. In this new book of mine that David referred to, which hopefully is coming out in the summer, what I'm trying to argue is that from the American side, there is a long trajectory of emphasis on global hegemony in ideological terms, although not necessarily always in military terms or in terms of policymaking. Multilateralism appears only when seen as absolutely necessary for the American state, such as in the 1940s, in terms of the challenges that came up there, both the Second World War and the early phase of the Cold War, or in the 1980s, where indeed multilateralism was the key to what was needed in order to settle the Cold War. And Reagan realized that, just as many of the advisors that he worked with in the second period came belatedly to realize it. Now, this is not the same thing as de-emphasizing the new military level of confrontation that has taken place after September 11th. In that sense, I agree with what Mick said, that the world is a very different place after what happened in New York and Washington and in Pennsylvania on that day. But many of the tendencies in terms of the American method of warfare that was put into motion after September 11th were already in place well before then. Indeed, many of these elements were already discussed during the 1980s without having a specific enemy in mind. I like to quote William Lind, an American conservative who is, by the way, no supporter of this administration's Iraq policy, who wrote already in 1989, and I quote him, "In broad terms, fourth-generation warfare, what the Americans are conducting at the moment, seems likely to be widely dispersed and largely undefined. The distinction between war and peace will be blurred to the vanishing point. It will be nonlinear, possibly to the point of having no definable battlefronts or battlefields. The distinction between civilian and military may disappear. Actions will occur concurrently through all participants' depth, including their society as a cultural and not just a physical entity," unquote. This fourth generation of warfare is what many of the people who constitute the current Bush administration believe in. This is what they believe that they are waging. They were waging in Afghanistan. I think will be waging at an even higher level in Afghanistan later on when the resistance become more active than what it is today, and certainly what they are waging in Iran. It has a cultural objective. It is trying to deal with countries that have gone bad for some reason, as seen from Washington. Military efforts has become part of setting the world right, not in a broad sense as to traditional warfare, and Mary Kelder touched on this 2 weeks ago, but also in the narrow sense of using instruments of military power to set not just states, but societies right. And this is what is scary, in my opinion, with the new level of interventionism that we find after September 11th. It is the mixing of the ideological fervor that exists in this administration with the concept often summarized as the fourth generation of warfare. The problem is that these directions within American politics, and it's not just the administration, you find much of this represented in much wider sense in American society as well, is that on a global scale, I would argue that the revolutionary challenge to American power is mounting. It's very diverse. It's not in any way just connected to Islamism or in some countries to the left. There are other kinds of movements as well. But the United States is facing a world that is less and less willing to accept its global and very often invasive hegemony. At the conference of former spooks, and undoubtedly some present spooks as well, that I attended in Washington recently, where they discussed whether Al-Qaeda was, in their words, a transnational corporation, like Starbucks, or a loose franchise, like more like 7-Eleven, and they couldn't quite make up their mind on the point, it became abundantly clear to me that there is a complete lack of grasp, even among the intelligence professionals who should be delivering the discussion points to the present administration, of the character of global Islamism. In my opinion, and this is something that we've discussed again and again at the talks in this series, in my opinion, much of Islamism, although not all of it, and certainly much of Islamism in the Middle East, comes out of real demands for a US withdrawal from the holy places, and now increasingly elsewhere, for a Palestinian state, and so on. There is nothing particularly esoteric about these demands. One may disagree with them, or certainly disagree with the kind of violence that is being used both within the region and elsewhere to underline them, but they are real and concrete demands. It's not a question of making everyone in the world a Muslim. It is not a question of trying to destroy the United States as such. These are real and tangible demands from a real and tangible enemy. Let me conclude then by saying that I think, like John Mersheimer did, comes from a very different tradition from mine, let me underline, in the first lecture in this series, that the only response that will prevent perpetual war is for the United States to limit its own security interests, somehow and some way. This is clearly an anti-interventionist argument, and it's an anti-interventionist argument that can be made by neorealists and historians alike, I'm glad to say. It was a wonderful moment during that first lecture when John Mersheimer leant over to me and he said, "This war makes for strange bedfellows." And I was nodding my head in agreement. So if there is a lesson from the Cold War, I think it's this. And I make this by pointing back to the 1980s and the way the Great Contest ended. Only by reinventing itself as a state among other states, with due respect for sovereignty, for international law, can the United States avoid what Gore Vidal recently has called perpetual war for perpetual peace? Thank you.
Well, give them 20 minutes each, and they took 30. And so yeah.
So the last thing I was
keeping the time. So the last thing we want is them to comment on each other and to give you, the audience, I think better now at 7:30, a chance to critically reflect on what they said. I mean, since we're talking about the Cold War, I was quite struck listening to them by the similarities in both talks to a famous couple of lines in Marx's wonderful 18th Brumaire, where he wrote that men make history, but not only in circumstances of their own choosing. The weight of tradition hangs like a nightmare on the brain of the living. Well, our first speaker really talked about the second part of that sentence, the weight of tradition hanging like a nightmare on the brain of the living, the Cold War locking in mentalities into the shape of contemporary politics. But you spoke more to the first half a little bit when you said personalities matter, agents choices matter, politics can be remolded, coalitions matter, challenges to US position are global, can the US self-limit, etc. So it's an interesting set of diverse positions, diverse sort of theoretical traditions speaking to these contemporary issues, and enough to get your teeth in. So go for it. I usually take questions in classes of five, but I think since these talks are more specific, we'll perhaps just take a couple of questions at a time and ask our little panel to be brief in response. Mike's, yeah.
Thank you very much. The Warsaw Pact is no longer with us, but I don't think either of you mentioned the predominant Western institution of the Cold War, NATO. What does the future hold for NATO? Will it survive? And what might its role be?
I have a comment for Professor Wested. Did I understand you right that you said that the period during the Reagan administration up to this September 11th was a period of multilateralism? Because this period also includes the attack, the NATO attack on Yugoslavia, which was unilateralist as much as the war in Iraq was. The difference was that instead of having the coalition of the willing, you had NATO. They had no authority from the world body. It was against the United Nations charter.
Do you want to both comment briefly on this?
Maybe I'll have a quick go at that first question about NATO very quickly. It's true. I mean, here is a Cold War survival. It is still there. And in some senses, I suppose partly points to my broader argument about continuities. I mean, I suppose one of the problems about dealing with continuities is that how things also alter but look the same. And I think that is also very important to tease out. And I think if we look at the NATO structure, I mean, on the one hand, you see this kind of desperate sense that you've got to hang on to NATO for all the obvious long-term reasons. It's the best bet America has in Europe. NATO has also become, I think, a very serious element in the way in which America structures its hegemony in Europe, particularly in relationship to building up alliances with new Europe against old Europe. And I think that kind of thinking at least was there with Rumsfeld. It may not be with all within this administration. And so NATO will obviously survive, and it will survive in all sorts of other ways. I mean, in post-conflict situations, NATO trains together and can do peace together. So I think those kinds of it will remain in being. But, I mean, if the last few years have proven anything, it's also actually also been, if I might put it bluntly, almost the utter irrelevance of NATO as well in terms of American grand strategy. I mean, immediately after 9/11, I mean, the Europeans, I mean, they would send anything. I mean, you know, they were going to send anything to help the United States after 9/11. We had Article 5 passed within, you know, 20 seconds of 9/11. It was the first time Article 5 was ever in vote. The attack on one is an attack on all. And the United States, it didn't exactly say piss off, but I mean, it said something quite close to it, which is, well, so what? And when they came then to Afghanistan, it was clearly going to be an American-led war. Now, I think there's a whole series of things going on in the 1990s, the kind of unexplored period, that interregnum, as I once called it, between the end of the Cold War and the War on Terror, in which I think certain quite really revisionist and radical views about NATO were beginning to float around this around people now in this administration. Certainly lessons drawn from the Kosovo War. You can't fight wars by ringing up the Greeks to say you want to bomb a bridge across the Danube, you know, as it was put to me rather nicely by one particular figure. So I do think there is a sense in which, yeah, the skeleton lives on. It will continue to function. It will continue to perform certain important roles. Is it the NATO as it was in the wonderful old days when there were 175 divisions or whatever they were about to come down the Fall de Gap? No. And it's simply not as central to American grand strategy. And in some sense, you might say, well, so what? But, yeah. Do you want to take the second question?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I probably would go even further in underlining the general irrelevance of NATO in terms of American foreign policy at the moment. It's not that the Americans do not want NATO, but they can't see no meaningful way in which it can work for their purposes. I mean, this is the problem. I mean, this is the Iraq problem in itself. I think probably Mick is right that NATO will survive at least for the time being. What we can be absolutely certain of is that it will not survive another American unilateralist intervention in a key third world area. And this, of course, you know, a key aspect of the way European leaders have to reconceptualize world power over the next decade or so. On the issue of multilateralism, and the point I was trying to make is that from the mid-1980s, and probably, I would say, starting before Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union, the United States was beginning to move in an almost unprecedented multilateralist direction. There were reasons for this. Some of these reasons had to do with general developments in the Cold War, not least in the Third World War. Had much to do with American politics as well, developments there, which I didn't have time to touch on much in my remarks. I do not think in any way that the bombing of Yugoslavia, which I the remainder of Yugoslavia, which I opposed, takes anything away from that. I think the American attempts were very clear to put together a very broad coalition based, in the end, on NATO, on its main NATO partners, in order to intervene. The Bush administration's instincts on this after September 11th have been completely different. The attempts that they made were attempts that were unilateral at the very beginning, as Mick pointed out in his comments.
I can see already several people wanting to ask questions, so I think I'll take four, five now. And I'd like to particularly see hands upstairs, because I've got a few people waiting here, and then we'll come up. Okay, Margot.
I would like to argue against the irrelevance of NATO. It seems to me that it's just been reborn, because one of the problems with the American pursuit of primacy is that it's fine to win the war, but it's not very useful in winning the peace, and that NATO, therefore, has been given two new roles. One is socializing the new members, and the other is acting as the nation builder and the peacekeeper. And I think that leads me back to ask you the question about the wrong lessons, because surely it was taking the wrong interpretation from the end of the Cold War, that it was preponderance of power that won the war, which is leading to an awful lot of errors now. I mean, one could equally say the United States won the war because the Soviet Union stopped fighting the Cold War. That if there was a victory, it was a victory of ideas and of capitalism rather than a military victory. And therefore, they may be preparing quite well for a future confrontation with China, but it's really not much use in dealing with the dangers that come out of the war against terror.
I'd like to pass the mic behind you.
Hi. Well, I noticed both of you talked about wrong lessons, but I don't think you have really said many about right lessons. I just wonder whether either of you tell me about what do you think, then, say, Soviet Union, now Russia, learned any right lesson from the Cold War, and same for United States. So one for Mick, one for Anna.
Would you not agree that the real similarity between the Cold War and the War on Terror is the fear of the threat of violence and not the actual use of armed force, be that nuclear deterrence or a single act of terrorism? What could we actually learn from that about the utility of our standing armed forces and the fallacy that they can actually defend us?
A couple of questions from the top, yeah.
If I could just make three points which perhaps you could address. The first...
Brief point.
The first one regarding Ronald Reagan. I was just struck by the difference between one speaker belittling Ronald Reagan and the other one, in a sense, rehabilitating him. And I'm sure, I wonder if that speaker 10 years ago would have probably joined the belittling of Ronald Reagan. But given now the different way which we see how the Cold War ended, his position has changed. Secondly, regarding Islamism, it seems that you were implying that, well, America's mistake was going to Afghanistan and Iraq. But, you know, 9/11 happened before that. And before that, there was the previous strike on the Trade Center. There were bombings elsewhere. My final point is, which I think you've both avoided, is North Korea. If you look at the Clinton administration, the agreed framework, I'm sure you probably applauded that at the time, but we all, I'm assuming you'd agree now that was a mistake. And if you look at the Bush administration now, that is the kind of the multi-panel approach, which I don't know if you're going to applaud or not. You haven't made any mention to it.
A very interesting comparison between the Cold War and today war on terror. Of course, there is a very substantial difference, which is today the enemy is not so well defined geographically, so the very term war on terror is contradictory. It's of course impossible to wage a war in the conventional sense against such an elusive enemy. What worries me, it's a chilling comparison which you have made regarding human rights abuses, which is probably the most substantial part of the comparison. I mean, I believe that what's happening today in Uzbekistan and several other areas, it's really appalling. And I think this is. I wonder if you can expand on that. Thank you.
Okay, give you just a few moments each to respond, because there are several other people who want to ask questions. So I'd like to get to you in a moment.
I'll be as quick as possible. It was obvious that Arnie's rehabilitation of Ronald Reagan really has to be talked about later, Arnie. I however do think there's an interesting question about Reagan, the myths of Reagan, and the way in which Reagan has been constructed by this administration. In a way, somebody said to me that whenever George Bush looks in the mirror, he sees Ronald Reagan. He sees the strong Ronald Reagan of the first administration and all the rest of it. And I think Alan is absolutely right. I mean, you know, if one's looking at the way in which the Cold War came to end, there was a simple different Reagan in the second term. But the Reagan they want to construct is not the second term Reagan. That is not the Reagan they want. It is the first term Reagan of the Axis of Evil, the evil empire, and all the rest of it. They want the tough Reagan, the Reagan of uncompromising moral clarity. That's why I use Sharansky as a kind of example. So it's not just the historical problems about interpreting Reagan, it's the way in which this administration has appropriated a particular kind of Reagan to in a sense, justify, legitimize their own particular positions. On North Korea, quickly, actually, I disagree with you fundamentally. I actually do think the 1994 agreement, which was struck between the United States, South Korea, and North Korea, was the best on offer. It was the best we had. And as everybody has seen subsequent, since the North Koreans have withdrawn from the NPT, and I'm actually doing some work on this at the moment, we are in such a mess now. We are really in danger. We are in a really dangerous situation. Now, I'm not going to blame all that on Bush. I mean, the fundamental responsibility for that lies with the North Korean regime. Let's be absolutely clear about that. This regime sees its survival in either getting or now acquiring nuclear weapons. Regime survival is central to their view of the world, and nuclear weapons are central to that. However, there is a cost which has to be paid because of the Iraq war, and that has to be paid, and that cost is, and Kim Jong-il and his supporters have said it. Look what happened to Saddam without nuclear weapons. Of course. And clearly the North Korean regime, appalling, brutal, and disgusting as it is, and the sooner it disappears from the face of the earth, the better for the North Korean people. But, you know, they're not stupid, and they've drawn a very clear lesson from what happened to Saddam. And I think that's the real lesson, and not going back over what happened in 1994. Very, very quickly, on one other thing, what are the right lessons to draw from the Cold War? Well, I don't know. I wish I could think of one. Right now, perhaps Arnie, if you go first, and then I can then think of a decent. Well, I think the right lesson, actually, if I might say, get back to my Clinton apologetics. I think Clinton drew actually the right lessons that if you're looking in a post-Cold War world, you want to start thinking about new ways of thinking about how to organize global order without an enemy, without a threat, without a massive military machine to make it, and to work alongside others. That I think is a lesson that could have been drawn. That is a lesson that might have been drawn correctly from the way the Cold War was fought. Maybe that is the correct lesson. But in a sense, who stands now as a sort of the joke president of the whole pack, from Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan? It's Jimmy Carter, the most decent guy to occupy the White House for 4 years, in the same way that they're now treating Bill Clinton. You know, they're treating him in the same kind of way. This is a kind of a joke of history. You know, the gap, you know, between when the real guy, you know, really came back into play to make real politics and real foreign policy, and look at the mess we're in.
Okay.
Arnie.
On the question of NATO, what Margot Light was saying, I think is absolutely true. I mean, there is a a new role for NATO that has been defined, and which may possibly, in the role of peace builder and peacekeeper, that may fit the interests both of the main European powers and the United States. The problem is to apply it in a way that would also fit the overall specifically defined state interests of these countries. In general, this is all well and true. In specific detail, and particularly when you're dealing with out-of-area operations, it becomes incredibly difficult, and I think increasingly difficult, and I think it will end eventually with NATO maybe keeping its name, but transforming itself into something very different from a defensive alliance that we have been seeing up to now. Saki Duckwin on right lessons in Russia and the United States from the Cold War. None of them have learned very good lessons from the Cold War, if there are any good lessons to be learned. My lesson from the Cold War, more or less Mikhail Gorbachev, the first state leader of the 20th century who realized that it might be in his country's own interest to redefine not just the manner of doing things within, setting a country free, as it were, but also to redefine in the most dramatic way possible what the aims of that state were abroad. Now, there were reasons included in this and included in the policy choices that he made that, in my opinion, and I've written about this extensively in the past, that led to the collapse of his project. But that doesn't take anything away from the fact that I think if you really want to sustain an international society of the sort that many of us are still hoping for, that is the way to develop, not through wars in Chechnya or interventions in the Middle East. Lastly, Reagan rehabilitation. Now, it has been said that my relationship to the sadly departed President Reagan is a bit tongue-in-cheek, and it is a bit tongue-in-cheek in the sense that I do not want for a minute to exaggerate this president in terms of, one, what he achieved on a domestic scale and on an international scale, but certainly in terms of his own abilities to lead policy. I think Reagan, towards the end of the second period, was really no longer there at the center of policy. What's interesting, though, about him is that because of that, should we term it, simplicity, Reagan was able to break away from some of the ideologues, break away from some of the people who wanted confrontation, who really wanted nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union. And there were some people in this administration from the very beginning who believed in that. And in that sense, Reagan was no Reaganite. When Bush looks himself in the mirror and sees Ronald Reagan, I think from the very beginning, even in the first period, he sees an ideologically created image. And the problem with that man is, of course, he could as well look himself in the mirror and see Thomas Jefferson. So the problem here is the redefinition of all of American history, not just Ronald Reagan, that is going on at present, and which is something that scares me very profoundly.
Right, two people desperate to ask questions from previous rounds. Keep them very short. Yeah, and then where's the mic? Yes, you've been waiting for a long time. This gentleman first, and then.
Picking up on something that Professor Westad was saying earlier about Islamists having concrete aims. I mean, yes, they do. They don't want everyone to be a Muslim, but they want everyone in the Middle East and North Africa to be united under a dictatorial caliphate, and they do want a Palestinian state, but where Israel is now. Can the United States possibly sensibly recede its security considerations so as to leave that out? And if it can't, isn't some kind of democracy promotion in that region probably the best way forward that you can think of?
Something else that we don't know? What's the war really about if it's just a construct?
Two questions. We're going to take a few just little statements just to get you to...
Well, the main contrast is, well, during the Cold War, particularly what I remember the 1980s, obviously Chomsky and C&D were basically saying that, you know, the Soviet threats was all a myth, you know, manufactured by the military industrial complex, etc., and of course it wasn't really exist. You know, the point is, whatever one thinks of those arguments, what I find fascinating is that all those arguments, I'm saying of what Chomsky and C&D, etc., what they argued rightly or wrongly about the Soviet threat, of course, was all quite correct about the threat from Iraq, because that really was a completely fabricated and manufactured threat. So I just find it ironic that their arguments, the positing in 1983 or whatever about the, you know, about Reagan administration, all came correct in 2003 with representative American allegations about the an Iraq threat, which in fact was non-existent.
Yes. Yeah, next. And then you waiting up there?
What's going on? I was just wondering to what extent the panel think that the Cold War has conditioned policymakers to think in terms only in terms of states as their unit of analysis in IR, and whether there was any other options open to them apart from traditional interstate diplomacy and warfare.
And finally,
I'm wondering whether there'd be a difference between the Cold War then and the War on Terror is that the Cold War was essentially between the big powers. Whilst it relied on tension between the big powers, it was actually very stable because Europe was extremely stable in that period, unlike it had been before. And whether now there are so many unknowns or unquantifiables or semi-knowns sort of factors which make international relations that much more unpredictable. And also, if the United States is the sole, as it is, the sole major power in the world today, whether a unilateralist thrust in its foreign policy is inevitable under whatever presidency, as it tries to deal with new problems like a coalescing Europe and things like that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your such disciplined questions. Let me just abuse my position for 30 seconds and try a 30-second paradigm shift by way of a question. I just wonder how far and how successfully you can tell a story of the last six decades just by focusing or primarily focusing on the Cold War and geopolitics. Geopolitics is, after all, one source of power among others. Or to put the point differently and just simply, I mean, Joe Nye talks about the global stage as a three-dimensional chess set, geopolitics and coercive power at the top, geoeconomics and soft power at the top. America's clearly hegemonic. The second, it's already a multipolar world. The world is already far more complex economically than any single models of hegemony would suggest. And at the final level, soft power is chaotic. And then, of course, you have interactions between the three levels. Mm. By the time you get to Michael Mann's four-dimensional views of power, it's even more complex. And therefore, the narratives you need to tell a commanding story of 1945 onwards wouldn't put geopolitics and coercive power in one place, among others. Mm. So what then might this suggest for the positive lessons that can be learned from this era? Well, some of them are not yet mentioned. Social movements matter. Extraordinary utopian things that you might judge as utopian, judged by the standards of coercive power, can happen, the peaceful velvet revolutions. Democracy and human rights can trump tanks and coercive power. Economic well-being and prosperity counts. All the coercive power in the world, brackets the Soviet Union, is not enough to win consent. Now that's the beginnings of a very different kind of politics, and those are lessons which could have been learned in Iraq and haven't.
Hmm. Let me just say, I to a very high extent agree with that, as I indicated in my talk. I think the problem, though, I mean, if you approach this as an historian, is that only to a very small extent have you started really dealing with the end of the Cold War and how the Cold War ended. And the general hegemonical narrative that exists of that is of power works. It is of a Reagan administration that trumped the Soviet Union on all these matters, all these nice different levels of interpretation. Now, part of my rehabilitation of the Reagan administration is intended to subvert that specific narrative. And it's part of the reason why so many of the people who've written about this earlier are terribly annoyed with my sneaking around in the Reagan library and getting to some of the newer materials that have become available. But more on that later. So one final point before I turn over to Mick. On the Middle East, can peace be a possibility in terms of American interventionism? I doubt it very much. I think the agenda of creating democracy, I mean, the Bush agenda of creating democracy in the Middle East, is not what the Middle East needs at the moment. What it does need is for the different peoples that exist there and for the different political groups to start interacting, to start talking. It's not about democracy as a vain and fairly empty ideal. It is about issues such as sovereignty, such as respect, such as being able to engage not the bin Ladens of this world, but the millions who have taken up a what you could term a soft Islamist position, very different from what you have found earlier on. Many of these people had changed their ideological views, changed their positions dramatically in the wake of the Cold War. Very many of these are people who had believed in very different ideals earlier on, but now feel themselves driven towards, I mean, wrongly in my opinion, but that's the way they see it, towards an Islamist agenda. If you do not engage these people, the possibility of ever creating peace in the Middle East is not there.
And 1 minute for you. Only one. Okay, fine. I'll be okay. I won't deal with Syria, Lebanon, Korea, Iraq, and everything else. I will, however, deal with stupidity. And it may come back to the question that was posed by David, and not stupidly, I hasten to add. You can make things worse. You can make things a lot worse. And if there's one lesson to be drawn from the Cold War, there are certain moments in which you hold back, in which you take sound advice, in which you balance what you're doing up against your capabilities. You look who your friends are. You look what you're capable of doing. That's a kind of lesson that, this kind of realist lesson, is not a terribly liberal thing to be suggesting. And, you know, if you're looking at the way the Cold War was fought, I mean, actually, there were certain moments in that Cold War when the United States acted with huge intelligence, with huge capacity for understanding what were the serious sources of conflict in the world. You know, we go back to the myths of the Marshall Plan and all the rest of it, but just, I don't want to go back over that issue, but, you know, they understood very well in 1945 and 46, it was hunger and poverty, disillusionment and all the rest, which created the conditions of support for either the Soviet Union or for various communist parties in Western Europe. What did they do? What did George Kennan, and one of the wisest of wise people, said? He said, well, we're not going to confront this through arms, through, even through NATO, not through military alliances. We'll do it by making our own system attractive. We'll do it through aid. We'll do it through political measures. We'll do it through cultural measures. We'll do it through the means which makes us attractive. You know, and I think, and I'm not saying the United States did that throughout the whole period. I mean, I'm not saying that. But it does seem that was wise. And we talk of those kind of wise men in that early period. And they were wise because they didn't act stupid. You know, and I do think there's been a hell of a lot of stupidity in this administration, frankly. I have to say that. I think they had some horrible choices to make. Let's be blunt. After 9/11, I'm not sure anybody was going to come up with the right formula for doing this. I can fully understand that. I don't say I'm patronizing. You can fully understand that kind of, that sense of panic, that sense of bewilderment about what was actually happening, and a fear that worse could happen. And let's accept that their worst-case analysis was something which was believed. If these guys got nuclear weapons, my God, we were in real trouble then. So let's be fair. But I think many of the things this administration has done subsequently have frankly just been stupid. I think it was stupid to go into Iraq, you know. I think it was stupid to alienate all their friends in Europe. I think it was stupid to kind of lump everybody together, you know, in a way which made moderate Islamists and others simply have to run behind the more radical elements, because to do so, they would delegitimize themselves. They've done everything, in effect, to weaken their own position in the world. And that strikes me. I mean, frankly, I don't mind hegemons. You know, I'm actually quite happy with hegemons. I don't even actually mind American hegemony, as long as it wears a good liberal democratic, even and sometimes a social democratic face, because it's got to be part of the solution. We can't avoid this problem. We can't avoid the problem of the United States by simply denouncing it and saying, you know, let it go and die somewhere, you know. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And I think we've got to have that kind of dialogue, you know. Just don't be stupid, you know. Do bright and wise things. Learn maybe from the wise guys at the beginning of the period. I don't know.
Well, before we thank our speakers for a tremendously lively evening, can I announce that on Wednesday, the 2nd of March at 6:30 here at the Old Theatre, Professor Margot Light will speak on Russia and the War on Terror. So it remains for me to thank these guys for a very lively evening.
Thank you. Well, I'm good.